We all know that dinosaur bones have lasted for tens of millions of years. Well, don't assume the same for dinosaur skin. Only in the rare case, dinosaur skin gets fossilized so it retains some of its shape and looks something like a dried-out leather glove. One such dinosaur was discovered in North Dakota, and now a decade later, scientists are revealing what that dinosaur is telling them. NPR's Christopher Joyce has the straight skinny on Dakota the Dino Mummy.
A high school student found a buried fossil in the Badlands of North Dakota. He called in an expert to help him dig it up. That was Philip Manning, a paleontologist from the University of Manchester in England. When they dug deeper, Manning saw something that shocked him.
It was absolutely covered in what looked to be mineralized skin.
With support from the National Geographic Society, Manning organized a dig that took several years. They gradually uncovered a hadrosaur, a 25-foot-long dinosaur known as the cow of the Cretaceous, a duck-billed lumbering plant eater. They called it Dakota.
This looked like it had depth and structure to the skin, and that's what got us really excited. Almost nail clippings are still present. The tail is three-dimensional, intact skin. It's like a cone of skin slipped over the skeleton. It's beautiful. The arm is just, it's like shaking hand with a dinosaur. The three-dimensional skin envelope runs all the way around from the hand up to its armpit. It's quite remarkable.
The circumstances for this remarkable preservation had to be just so. Manning says the animal died about 65 million years ago and was quickly covered in water and silt, as well as chemicals from plants. This chemical soup was perfect for creating calcium carbonate, which permeated the skin and created a kind of cement envelope. The actual skin decomposed, but its shape and structure was frozen in time. The surface of the mineralized skin has a geometric pattern, like the outside of a soccer ball. That's what the hadrosaur's skin would have looked like in life. And Manning says even the inside of the skin is preserved.
You slice through the skin, and you can see original cell boundaries, which have been locked in the calcium carbonate cements of this remarkable fossil. And that, for me, is an absolute gobsmacking moment when we looked at that for the first time.
Writing in the Proceedings of the Royal Society in England, Manning says they're hoping they might find a whiff of organic material that could have remained within the mineralized skin. In recent years, other scientists have claimed to recover actual blood vessels and even proteins from inside dinosaur bone, but it's been difficult to prove that these organic materials aren't just contamination from other animals or bacteria. Chances are getting better for finding traces of tissue, though. New techniques, many borrowed from medical and chemistry laboratories, are helping scientists tease out even the most minute biological markers from animals fossilized for millions of years. Derek Briggs is a paleontologist at Yale University who specializes in looking for so-called soft tissue from long-extinct animals and plants.
Our analytical and imaging facilities are becoming much more sophisticated at a very rapid rate, and that's yielding all sorts of exciting new results about the chemistry and appearance of these kinds of animals.
Dakota hasn't yet revealed much that's new about dinosaur evolution, but Manning and his team believe this dinosaur's secrets are more than skin deep. And already, having the fossilized skin takes a lot of guesswork out of recreating what dinosaurs really looked like. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Three new genetic studies are providing some tantalizing hints about what causes schizophrenia. The studies identify sections of our genetic code in which small changes can affect a person's risk of developing the disorder. These include stretches of code involved in brain development, memory, and, surprisingly, the immune system. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
Schizophrenia has been incredibly hard to study. Kari Stefansson, who runs the Icelandic company Decode Genetics, says that's because of its very nature.
It's a disease of thoughts and emotions, which is, a disease of the two functions of the brain that define us as a species and define us as individuals.
Decades of research have yet to find much difference between the brains of typical people and those with schizophrenia. So Stephenson and a consortium of researchers from around the world decided to look for subtle differences in people's genes. The result is three studies involving thousands of people that appear in this week's issue of the journal Nature. Stephenson says one place the studies found a clue about what might be going wrong in the brains of people with schizophrenia was in a gene responsible for a protein called neurogranin. It can affect memory and thought.
So indeed, the neurogranin pathway could be one of the biochemical pathways that should lead to disturbance of thought.
But Stephenson says a more provocative finding is a genetic hotspot in a stretch of code that affects the immune system.
It raises the question that somehow the tendency to develop schizophrenia may have something to do with infections of mothers during pregnancy.
The idea is that some families carry a genetic variation that affects the way the immune system responds to infection. If a mother gets the flu while she's pregnant, this immune response may affect her child's brain. But it's also possible that the immune system is involved in schizophrenia in some other way. Dr. Tom Insel directs the National Institute of Mental Health, which helped fund all three studies. Insel says the stretch of genetic coding affecting immunity is pretty mysterious.
In some ways, it's a little bit like the Bermuda Triangle of the human genome. It's an area with tremendous amounts of variability, and it's an area where we often find variation that's associated with many different disorders: diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, many others.
In those diseases, the immune system attacks the body's own cells, and that could also affect the brain. Researchers have suspected the immune system before. Now they'll probably take a harder look. Insel says he's intrigued by the finding that some genetic variations linked to schizophrenia are also linked to depression and bipolar disorder.
It suggests, potentially, that when we're talking about the genetic factors that contribute, what we're really thinking about are genetic factors that contribute to how a brain gets built.
Which would mean problems in the brain start very early in life, even though the symptoms may not appear for decades. Dr. Pamela Sklar from Harvard, an author of one of the new studies, says the results suggest just how many different systems in the brain may contribute to schizophrenia.
That's a hopeful finding, because the implication is that there may be more places to intervene if we understand the biology.
She says that understanding gets better with each new genetic study. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Now, a grisly story about the tales that bones can tell. Forensic anthropologists look at human remains in order to identify the dead and discover clues about how they died. Only a handful of universities in the world offer space to study the decomposition of bodies, and the newest of those facilities is in Central Texas. NPR's John Burnett visited a class of graduate students as they spent the morning unearthing a skeleton.
I'm standing inside of the Forensic Research Center. This is on ranch land west of San Marcos, Texas, about an hour's drive south of Austin. It's covered with scrub oak, juniper, knee-high grass, limestone, pretty typical Texas hill country. What's atypical about it is that it's populated with cows and corpses.
My name is Michelle Hamilton. I'm an assistant professor at Texas State University and also the director of the Forensic Anthropology Center at Texas State. We're at the Forensic Anthropology Research Facility right now, which is about a 5-acre fenced-in plot of land that functions as a outdoor decomposition research facility.
So we're standing at the edge of a, looks like about a 4-by-12-foot trench, and in the bottom of it are some human remains, and they're sort of rust-colored, about the color of the soil. So how long have these remains been in this pit?
These remains have been here since February. This individual was brought out completely fleshed. We wanted to look at what the Texas sun and aridity and also the periods of rain would do to a skeleton here in Texas. As of right now, they're faster. The bodies mummify faster, they skeletonize faster, they decompose faster.
I'm Laura Ayers. I'm from Houston, Texas. I'm a second-year graduate student in forensic anthropology, and I want to be a professor and consult with local law enforcement. Right now I'm trying to get the pelvic girdle out, the hip bones. I don't want to pull anything because it might break it.
Four grad students are in the pit with the partially buried skeleton. They're clearing away compacted earth with trowels and brushes. As they dig deeper into the red soil, the putrid odor of decomposition wafts up. A slim, tattooed 30-year-old from New Orleans is holding the skull, alas, poor Yorick style, and picking dirt from the eye orbits.
My name is Teresa Gotay Nugent. I was born in Connecticut. I'm a graduate student in forensic anthropology. I plan to go down to South America and see if I can work on human rights cases.
Why do you want to do this with your life?
Even though we're working with the dead, we actually help the living, the families of people that are missing and feared dead. It's not all just macabre. It can actually make a difference doing this.
Two students gingerly lift out the bones and place them on a sheet of plastic in the crude form of a complete skeleton. The other pair continues to dig with shovels. One of them has been searching fruitlessly for the kneecaps for a half hour.
We like to find everything. It really frustrates us when we know that we're missing a major element. We want to be very thorough in trying to find everything.
The bones are placed inside a red plastic bag to be taken to the lab. Dr. Michelle Hamilton watches approvingly.
So how'd they do?
Okay, it looks like at the end of the recovery for this particular body, we have the majority of all bones recovered with the exception of two kneecaps and some of the phalanges, parts of the hands and feet. So they did really good.
They'll have to return later, screen the spaded dirt, and look for the missing bones. It's a meticulous process. Nothing gets left behind.
Would you like us to keep the fingernails?
You can put them in a bag. We'll go ahead and dispose of them when we get to the lab.
The recovery of the skeleton takes place with dignity. He was, after all, a man. In his 30s, he died suddenly, and his family gave his body to the Decomposition Research Facility with the understanding that he would further the knowledge of human osteology. In its first year, the Forensic Anthropology Center at Texas State University has received 7 donated bodies. That compares to more than 650 individuals in the collection at the much older facility at the University of Tennessee. Here, they need more donors. Asking for them is a delicate matter, but it must be done to understand the story of the bones. John Burnett, NPR News.